the meditation. Just take a moment to relax. Just invoking that inner friend, the attitude of that inner friend, and kind of an accepting, welcoming attitude toward your own body and toward whatever perceptions or thoughts or emotions that are taking place in the mind. Just relax and allow them to give them the freedom to just be what they are, with that accepting, welcoming attitude. Take a moment just to let the mind settle. Continue to relax. If there's any agitation in the mind, or frustration, or antsiness, just welcome that. Welcoming all of the experiences and sensations of the body, of your mind, and perceptions, allowing those the freedom to be as they are. Now just be yourself, just this me, the one who has a body, the one who has thoughts, the one who is present to all these sensations. So gently turn your focus just to your sense of me. Being yourself, in spite of any sensations or changes that are taking place. Notice the silent quietude, changeless presence of you. This very personal me, the sense of self, the one for whom all these perceptions and activities is for. Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavahai, tejasvinavati tamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Some of us are new to this, so could you just give a brief overview of what the Vedanta is all about and what the goal is? And that should probably help some of us also.
I'd like to know how you'll do that briefly, though. Oh.
Well, the meditation was a good little start. The Vedanta, it's really the teaching of the Upanishads from India. And the Upanishads are part of the Vedas, which are really an ancient scripture, and from their own standpoint, they're beginningless. So they come along with the creation, so they're viewed as revealed, like a revealed knowledge. So there's a lot to that, but just to kind of give you that type of orientation. The subject matter of the Upanishads is what is actually the nature of reality. What is the truth of this whole thing? So for us, just as individuals, we're experiencing this creation from within it. And yet we have no idea where we came from, what we're doing here. What is the nature of the whole creation? Is there some God in heaven? Is there a heaven and hell? Is there reincarnation, as some religions believe? But what is the truth of the whole thing? And it actually resolves into the who am I question. Who am I? Really? Is there someone that survives death? Is there someone, something about me that is free from dharma and adharma, or good and evil, or heaven and hell? Someone who's not subject to change. Really? So these questions don't occur to everybody. And if they don't occur, then you don't really need them answered, because you can do fine in a sense without them. Because in a sense, you always know who you are. And you know who you are as far as you're concerned, like I'm the one coming to class today. That takes care of that. This is my friend that I'm coming with. Or, you know, I'm a father of two kids, or I have three brothers and a few sisters, or whatever it happens to be, and this is what I do for a living, and this is where I live. So this I is relatively continually taken care of. I'm going for a walk. I'm going to sit in class. I. It's always contextualized, and so you're always kind of satisfied with a label. But at some point you want to know, well, who am I? That is all of these things. You know, because I'm not always sitting in class, I'm not always taking a walk, I'm not always the son to my father, the daughter to my mother, or whatever. These are all very relative terms. At some time you want to know. You also would like to know at some point, is there any way that I could just be happy and say, oh, okay, all is well with me, I've made it. In Sanskrit they call it the kritya krityaha. That which is to be done, I have done it. Now I can rest in my morals and all is well, and I don't have to worry about that anymore. So these questions come when they do, and when they do come, and a person really wants to know that who am I question, then the Upanishads become relevant. They become meaningful, because that is what they address, is who are you? What is the relationship between me, this person here, and the creation, and God, if there is a God? Who am I? Contextually, who am I? Is there something more than just this person sitting here? So the Upanishads, every one of them, there's many different Upanishads. They all exist within the Vedas, these scriptures of India. They always come at the end of the Vedas. They're called the Veda Anta. Vedanta is the end of the Vedas. Anta means end. So these Upanishads are really a dialogue between the guru, the teacher, and the sishya, the student. The guru is really the one who removes ignorance, the one who removes self-ignorance is the meaning of the word. And so the Upanishads are taught in this dialogical manner, and they're viewed that the teaching is not just a lecture. It's a teaching that's meant to point to your own nature. It's very systematically, step by step by step, so that you can actually recognize it. Because of that, the teaching is called a pramana. Pramana means a means of knowledge, like my eyes are a means of knowledge for seeing color, and my ears are a means of knowledge for hearing sound. The Vedanta, even though it takes place through words, it's a means of knowledge for knowing, for recognizing myself. The self for all of us is already here, you know, so it's not like you need a new experience of yourself, but you haven't differentiated your being, yourself, from all of the experiences, like the experiences of the body. the body seems to enjoy consciousness, so the body is consciousness, and when the body dies, consciousness will die. You know, you think you objectify and you're aware of your mind, but you take yourself to be the mind. So when the mind is happy, you're happy. When the mind is sad, you're sad. So the mind is present, the body is present, your energy is present, sense organs are present, and you are present. But there's the superimposition going on, which needs to be righted. But to do that requires just a very systematic pointing out certain factors, very systematically. Pointing out things about your experience that you most likely have not recognized, but once they're said, you recognize them. And so, say if I continue to point out the experience that you're actually having and make you notice things about that experience, your relationship, like between, for instance, yourself and your mind, will change. Because initially you have a relationship. It's not a relationship, it's just I and my mind. But when you realize and experience that actually you're aware of your mind and you're not changing as your thoughts are, that is a momentous occasion when you realize that. That means there's a home, the mind has a home base. So there is a very systematic progression of teaching that takes you to the recognition of kind of the non-dual, changeless nature of your being. And that being that you are is the being that I am, is the being that all creatures are, is the very being that lights up and supports the entire creation. So that's quite different. That vision is quite different in a way from what we're used to. But it is very similar to the dream. If you have a dream, the whole dream comes from you, right? It's your dream, it comes from you. It's sustained by you. It resolves back into you. It's your dream, you're the self of that dream. And when that dream is taking place, there are many characters in the dream and you're identified with one of them. And you're viewing the whole dream from within the dream. But when the dream resolves and you wake up, nothing has happened to you. It's not like you, when the dream character you're identified with goes away, it doesn't. You are exactly the same as you were before in terms of your being, and you even recognize that nothing has really happened. The difference between the dream and this is the dream is subjective, and there's also still self-ignorance. So self-ignorance is there because you don't really understand what has happened there, but you do have that experience of waking up from the dream and nothing has happened to you, and you know that you're the self of the whole thing. Maybe in the dream identified with a character in it, but when you wake up from the dream, you know that's your dream, you're the self of the whole thing. You have a similar experience with imagination. Like if you have an imagination, that imagination comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves back into you. If you're identified, even in this, you know, like a daydream, you're identified with a character in the imagination, then you experience that character is experiencing imagination from within the imagination. But when you withdraw the imagination, you're just still you, the self of the whole imagination. So this teaching, we have these illustrations like this that are really useful. But I think to understand the whole purpose of the Upanishad is to kind of make you recognize the self that you already experience as you, but have put all this baggage on. So it's a matter of recognizing that the self you are is free in a very beautiful way. That the ananda that you've been seeking, the fullness, the happiness you've been seeking from the world, is your own nature. That's why you think you, by doing this or doing that, you'll become happy. But you do become happy for a few minutes. That's all, really. Yeah. Probably all of us have experienced that, fulfilling some big desire and being so happy and so excited within a few minutes, if you last that long. Another desire comes up, you know. you know, over some period of time, even the desire that you had for that wonderful experience or object or person isn't even there anymore. So that's a little disconcerting, especially when you start really noticing it. You thought this would make you so happy, it gave you a blast of happiness, and then there's nothing. You have the object now, but you're still a seeker. And so the Upanishads are addressing all of these questions and really what the relationship it is to you with your own seeking of ananda, of fullness, your own relationship with God, if there is one, your relationship with the creation, your relationship with the body, what is the truth of all of that. So it's a very systematic, thorough analysis of all of that. That is not just an intellectual pursuit, because everything that's being talked about is here experientially. And so the words are always resolving into your experience and also removing certain beginningless ignorances around your experience for the better. Mm-hmm. It's much better to have a stable self than a self that is you have no control over, really. An emotional self that you have no control over. A self that's bound by birth and death, when that's not true. You know, and it's not, I'm not bound by an emotional self. Even if the emotions are there, the self isn't bound by them. But that requires some discernment, some teaching. And then it becomes like, as Shankara says, it becomes like night and day. It becomes very, very clear. But until it's clear, it's not. You know. So that's basically what it, the arena that we're working in. So.
Since you're talking about emotions, that was my big question, is what does the Shastra say about the function of emotions, their purpose?
I don't know that it says anything about their purpose. What would you say their purpose is? And I can make some things up or say just put two and two together. But why are you asking the question? What is the answer you're looking for?
It seems that from the standpoint of survival, emotions are information that we're getting from whatever context we're in. And then that's informing us to behave a particular way for our survival. Like, just as a living creature, like, you know, seeing and feeling, you know, and then mm-hmm. emotions is like an intellectual, pseudo-intellectual experience that you may not have actually made sense of. It's like, I mean, according to this one neuroscientist, he says that we used to think thought comes before emotions, but with a brain-injured patient he had, he realized it's actually the other way around, and that we require the emotions in order to get the cognition. Now, I don't know how, like, thorough that is, mm-hmm. but I thought that was really profound, because it kind of makes sense when you think about it from the standpoint of perception, and then the emotion would be like another layer of making sense of that perception, and then you would make a cognition from that, you know, decide okay. about it.
Well, that could be true. That's kind of going into science and kind of outside of the bounds of Vedanta, so I'm not sure.
Sure, but I just meant as an example, when I was answering the question, you know, that kind of makes sense. Just, it has a certain logic to it that seems to make more sense than what people say about the rational mind dismissing emotion, you know, like that it's not somehow important.
Well, okay.
Does that help?
Well, I'm sure. But though I'm not going to answer your question exactly, I don't have an answer for it, but I would say that in one way the emotions are very connected with Dharma and Adharma. And so Shanti itself is very connected. The state of mind is very connected with Dharma and Adharma. And Shanti, that peace means peace or quiet mind, a relaxed mind. That quiet, relaxed mind allows for the kind of expression of all of the positive emotions. Where a stressed or tense mind gives, we have many names for them, but they're just all kind of the negative, hurtful emotions or emotions that we would rather not have, I would say like that, like irritation, anxiety, anger, rage, depression, sadness. We have an emotional spectrum. And so the negative side of the emotional spectrum, unless it's a chemical problem, often has to do with attitude. Mm-hmm. We think that these emotions have to do with what's actually happened to me out here, but actually it has much more to do with how I receive the data, whatever's coming in. And so because of that, the more understanding I have, especially with self-knowledge, the more shanti I have, the more peace I have. And so that gives me more access to the positive spectrum. Not that for somebody who has self-knowledge, I call it like a secondary gain, that the positive spectrum is much more present than the negative spectrum. But why that is because the mind has discovered the very source of that wholeness, to be my own being, my own changeless being. And so I'm not as dependent upon people or dependent on the world or dependent on a situation to be a particular way. And since I'm not dependent, to the degree I'm not dependent, I can be with whatever the situation is. I enjoy shanti. But it's because I don't need the creation to make me happy. Happily, I experience the creation. If I understand, if I've recognized that my own, that myself is really the source of all of these happy experiences that just come and go because of the condition of the mind, once I recognize that the Atma, the self, is the source of that, it is the fullness which reflects in a variety of ways in a peaceful mind. So now to have a peaceful mind, not talking about knowledge at the moment, but just to have a peaceful mind, just in the world, really depends upon your attitude. And what if your attitudes are ruled by Dharma? And Dharma is basically, to put it very simply, and this is something that is true in every culture, the top of Dharma would be ahimsa, non-injury. That's at the top. I like the word kindness as a positive term. I say kindness. As a negative term, I would say non-injury. So sometimes it's difficult to know what we do our best to be kind or to not hurt other beings. Sometimes it's a complicated situation, but we do our best. And underneath that is the golden rule. Mm. For all they have it. It's written in Sanskrit. So this is passed down through all of the religions and spiritualities. In India, the full text of the Golden Rule is, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, and don't do to others what you wouldn't have done to yourself. This is such a beautiful rule. And if that Dharma becomes our highest value, even though we can't live up to it all the time, we fail here and there, but nevertheless, it is our highest value, you know, then that becomes a real guide for us, how we treat others. How would I want to be treated in that situation? And even if you, without knowledge, let's say you fail here and there, you also, if you fail at it, when you fail at it, you feel really badly. It doesn't work to fail, but that's the great teacher, you know. And so your angers and your rages and you're blaming, all of these type of things. If you take those painful emotions as kind of like Dharma, a Dharma holding up its hand in terms of my attitude, then I can work to change my attitude. You don't have freedom so much to change other people. Mm-hmm. if you really need to change other people, you're kind of in trouble. Yeah. And it's the same with the life situations also, because there's prarabdha involved that puts us in life situations. Some are good, like they say, we kind of jokingly, but tongue-in-cheek truth, that in the life, it's more in this life, in this plane, because in India we have, you know, heaven worlds up and heaven worlds and hell worlds down. There's more than just going to heaven and hell. There's different planes of existence because of reincarnation. They accept that. In this particular plane, it's considered the loka, the world where you can get liberation, and you also have this doership, and you have the power of the karma that caused you to take this birth, go through a whole lifetime of experiences with free will. You know, free will to respond to those situations. Your freedom is more in your response than anything else. And you can respond with Dharma or with your value system, or you can ricochet off what is happening to you. Right, so if you're ricocheting off, you have a bad experience as though designed to cause pain. And we say 50-50, 50% of the experiences are designed to cause pain. They're not meant to make you happy, but what if you don't care about it? If they make you happy or not, I have my own self. I am the Ananda. I don't need to have a happy situation in order to be happy. And that's when you can really be happy, when you don't need a happy situation to be happy. Then you have some freedom. Otherwise, you're totally bound. And so some of the situations that we have are challenging, but that's where Dharma comes in. The happy situations are not challenging. It's like Bhagavan's giving you a breather. You know, this is fine. Everything's good, you know. I know it won't last very long. I know it won't last very long, but it's nice to have this little respite here, you know. But you get used to the mind with knowledge, you get used to enjoying your own self, and you get used to enjoying being with the situation, whatever it is, because your ananda is not at stake. Then you can be interested in the situation. You don't expect everything to be, you're not the center of the world. The self is the center of the world, but you're not. So things are, you have to have really, you have hard times and you have good times. But how to be, so I would say, in terms of emotions, the negative emotions come because of the way I am with the situation. There are certain emotions that are very are Ishwara Shrishti, the Lord's creation, and those are instinctual emotions, natural emotions like grief at the loss of a loved one. That's a natural situation. How you handle that grief is another thing, but that grief is a natural, innate emotion. Fear, because a situation comes up and you're startled and you have fear, puts you on alert, you know? That's an instinctual emotion, so you have those kind. But then you have the jiva srishti, those that are arising because of the way you are in the situation. And to me, those are learning situations, that my emotions are teachers. They teach me. And so that's how I would. They teach me how to be. And it gives me something to contemplate on, especially if you have knowledge. How do I need to be in this situation? I'm talking about knowledge, because if somebody doesn't have knowledge, they would just go to Dharma, which is great. But we can go, knowing that the Ananda is yourself, how do I need to be in this situation in order to feel full and complete, for my mind to have that shanti? That's a wonderful meditation, because you can actually say you're having a horrible time, emotionally horrible time in a situation. You can actually do like an act of imagination and imagine a life with you in that situation and how you're responding and the pain and all of the things, agony it's causing or anger it's causing. And then you ask yourself, you know, what if I, how should I be in this situation in order to feel full and complete? And see what answers you get. And you can say, well, let me try that and imagine it. Seriously, you know that your imagination produces emotions. That's why we say, people are always doing this catastrophic thinking because you have an idea of how you want the life to be. And you look ahead in your imaginal mind into the future, and then you see all the things that could go wrong, or all the things that may not happen, and then you feel all those emotions. So that means, and people, we say people, and probably each one of us has experienced this, I imagine, that you spend much more time, you know, thinking about the past and the future than you do spending time in the present, right? And so a lot of that is in this future projection and seeing that that's not going to work out and I might not be able to, you have a desire and it's not going to work out and not maybe not going to be able to get what I want and this could happen and this could happen, this could get destroyed. And you are living that imaginal, that emotional, real emotions in this imaginal life. So that's very telling. You know, once you recognize and start looking at that, then you think, you know, I do much better in the present. Honestly, the present is so easy compared to the catastrophic life that we project for ourselves. It's much easier to deal with. You know, there's a in psychology, we have what's called, especially for little children, who can't, they just have to handle, they don't have, you know, they don't have reasoning or they can't make sense out of things really till they're 6 or 7. They just are having the experience. So the defense system has to come in, it comes in with a very creative way of handling these sad or hurtful experiences. So what happens is, let's say you have an angry parent, and every night that parent is going to be coming home. And then all of the kids are watching. Yeah, waiting. Worrying about it. That worry, because this person's coming, that worry is called anticipatory anxiety. You have anticipatory anxiety about this. That what's going to happen, what's going to happen, what's going to happen. Worried, the little kids, worried about it, worried, afraid, you know. And so what the psyche does is it lets that, let it happen right now. So they imagine it. They just imagine it. And then it's fine because now it's happening. It's much better than the anticipatory anxiety. It's amazing. That's an actual defense of the psyche, especially for children. Yeah, and so their mind just goes into a space of letting it happen now because they can't stand, you know, the anticipation, and then they settle down. It's a big relief. So how that kind of translates into our situation, even if this situation is bad, we seem it seems to be easy to us because it's so much better than the anticipatory anxiety of our imagination. You know, I don't really, if you think about it, the life that is here at the present is usually just fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be hard or this or that, but it's much better, much easier than what you do with your own mind.
I agree with that, but at the same time, my next question would be, then why do we even do it? There must be something in the order.
Well, we do have the order that we do have imagination and we do have desire. So desire is a big culprit, actually. Because the thwarted, even the Bhagavad Gita, we did this last at Sweden last year, it must be in chapter 3, where they go through and actually say, what is the order? What happens when you have a desire? Well, the desire itself is fine until it's thwarted. A thwarted desire produces krodha, anger. a thwarted desire produces anger, and from that you lose the, from that it goes into two or three different things, like the loss of your buddhi, your intellect to really make good decisions, and from that you lose your humanity, your humanness.
I agree, but I still have the question of, from the standpoint of Ishvara,
mm-hmm.
if we are behaving this way, whether we have knowledge or without knowledge,
uh-huh.
I mean, I suppose the closest answer to my question would be what you said earlier, that it's a teacher.
I think it's a great teacher.
So I'm just asking from the standpoint of Ishvara, why is it in the order for us to behave this way with or without knowledge?
Well, the order is Ishvara, right? Dharma is Ishvara.
Right.
Okay. And so what happens when you go against the order? You're kind of pushing against the walls,
right,
of the order, which is what the jiva can do. I mean, a jnani very rarely pushes against any walls, because I'm fine with it. Things like this, I would prefer to be with what is. Right, but if you don't prefer to be with what is, and you have an imagination about how you think you would like it to be, which is a direct result of ignorance, then you'll be pushing against that order, and that order will naturally push back. But you ask, why is it that way? Well, nobody decided it to be that way.
Right.
That's the nature of the creation. You know, it's not like Ishvara thought, how am I going to handle these? Let me put these jivas here, and how are we going to handle them? Yeah. No,
yeah.
That's not how it is.
Yeah, I didn't mean it exactly that way, but that there's, that there must be, if it's in the order, there must be a purpose to it. Or
the purpose is to keep everybody in Dharma.
Okay. So it's just,
if you think about there, let's say instead of for the purpose, what is the effect of it? It keeps it, the Dharma itself, right, is a great teacher. It's a great, great teacher, because as soon as you veer off of Dharma, you experience so many levels of emotion that are not nice. They're isolating. So you're isolating yourself from the whole, in a way, emotionally. So that's a great teacher. You know? But it's nice to be a great teacher with knowledge than a great teacher without knowledge, because with knowledge you know the truth. That you're on the ananda that you're seeking is your own nature. It doesn't really exist out here. And so you do much better to just appreciate the life that you've been given, because you have this life. You have it, it's for free. You have the life, you know. And then to really be present to this life and within Dharma, practice your values, which are highly rewarding. And the other negative values are highly punishing. You know, like if you're unkind to someone, you'll feel that unkindness. If you hate somebody, you feel that hatred. If you're mean to somebody, you feel the opposite of that meanness in yourself. And if you are loving to somebody or kind to somebody, then you get to experience all those emotions. So you learn over and over again, you know. And there's no exceptions in it. Even if for some unconscious reasons, or we have kind of what we call subtle likes and dislikes that certain people are hard to have around, and so you try to push them away, but you just feel terrible. There's no way around it. And so you're forced into being a good person. Bhagavan takes care of it, you know? And then you feel so happy that you finally gave up this particular, you know, neuroses that you had. Feels much, much better.
Neuroses reflect ananda also, though? I mean, like,
I was using that tongue-in-cheek, so
when we're talking about, like, the negative vrittis and everything,
yeah,
like, the whole spectrum is equal in
the ananda of your being is ever-present.
Okay.
But the ananda of your being is much different than the reflections of it in terms of from the most sublime, beautiful bliss vrittis all the way down to the hellish, dark, depressed, isolated vrittis, thought modifications, you know, emotional. There's an emotional spectrum. And so we feel most our being, the mind is most comfortable in the positive spectrum because it resonates with me, with my nature. The negative spectrum doesn't resonate with me at all. So if you're identified with your mind, you feel very isolated, very alone, very isolated, very unloved, very unwanted, all of this horrible spectrum. You know, which if you have knowledge, you can welcome that. You can welcome those feelings. You can let those feelings relax into your being, and they will dissipate, you know. But say you don't have knowledge, then you just project all of your rage and anger and hurt and isolation out, and this person did that, and it's because of this, and because of this. And then that is like lassoing all of these people and situations that have caused all of this, and you're carrying all of that around. Doesn't work. And I don't have to tell anyone that it doesn't work, because you all know it doesn't work, and I know it doesn't work, and that's the great teacher. You know, it doesn't work. So even if you don't like that it doesn't work, if you wish you could fight your way out of the thing and whatever, have your way, you can't. It's like the Dharma doesn't let you. That's it. It doesn't let you. Well, let me put it this way. It does not let you because it's punishing. Yeah. So it doesn't help. So sooner or later, over time, you keep giving up all of these unkindnesses. Mm-hmm. Because it's so much nicer to be kind. Mm-hmm. But our complexes and hurts go very deep. And so you have to... Got the top layer taken care of, and then the next layer is taken care of. Oh my God, there's no. So you have to be patient. You know that gaining that antikarana shuddhi, the purity of mind, the mind that naturally enjoys shanti. You could come into this life having done all of that work in a previous life, but you come into this life wherever you are. And you gain your teacher wherever you are. Within, if you gain a teacher in terms of this knowledge, then you haven't already have enough antikarana shuddhi, that shanti. You have enough peace of mind in order to even gain a desire for this knowledge. But you still may have a lot of issues to work on, or you may come to this knowledge and meet your teacher with. You've already worked on a lot of those issues. And so you have already much, much more shanti, much more peace. And say another person, but both of you have enough peace to gain this knowledge, but you still have enough work. You have work to do. And that's most of our situation. Most of us have a lot of work to do. Which should be fine. Who cares? You know, you learn to enjoy that work also, because it's very rewarding to go from some adharma or unkindness to kindness, even though sometimes it takes a lot of strength and a lot of courage.
Pujya Swamiji would talk about build up. How would that connect to what you're saying?
Well,
he talks about build up.
What he talks about build up is this, that say in any situation, like let's look at something that is kind of a natural emotion that will arise. Like grief for the loss of a loved one. Okay, that's a natural emotion. And so if you allow yourself just to be with the grief, there's something very, very beautiful about that, because your own being shines through it. There's something sacred about it. It really belongs to Ishvara. But when the individual's projections start coming on it, that adds another layer on top of this kind of pure grief. And that layer can be something like, this has ruined my life. Why did this have to happen to me? Why did God do this to me? You know? Why was I chosen for this? Yeah. What, you know? What did I do wrong? And then on and on, creating all kinds of reactions that are building off of the initial event. And that It's like building a web around the initial event, layer after layer after layer. It goes like a cocoon, you know? So that's what we mean by build-up. So say the grief happens and you're able to be with it, you know? Or the event happens and you're able just to be with it. Then you're with Ishwara. And there's no one resisting Ishwara. You're being objective. And it's not like just, oh, this is happening, so it's not like that. But you're with these situations, not building up, you're with Ishwara and you're objective. What is the best way to handle the situation? Then there's no build up. It's just objective. What is the best way to handle the situation? So Swamiji uses this word objective like this a lot. You have to be objective in the situation. Means you don't have this jiva srishti, this imaginal thing, you know, all of this blame and, you know, all the blame and anger and all these kind of things. That's all jiva srishti, the individual's imagination superimposed on. It's better just Ishwara srishti, you just be in the situation and handle to the best of your ability, where you're not producing a lot of buildup around it. Because then when you're producing the buildup around it, it's building up around you, your own mind. And then there's a lot of suffering. So.
Thank you, Radha.
You're welcome.
Could you say more about Ishwara and who, what that is, how to relate to it? I know it's the external
world. When we say that really what this knowledge is, to have self-knowledge, is to be able to say, I am Ishwara. That's what it means. I am Ishwara. It's not I am Brahman or I am the infinite self or I'm the limitless self. Conscious being. I'm a conscious being as well. That's not enough. You need to recognize that this whole universe, everything on every level, everything that exists within time and space, everything that is objectifiable, which would include everything I'm looking at now, but in an infinite, with an infinite extension to go out to every dimension, to the ends, almost infinitely probably to the ends of the creation, which has no end. Mm-hmm. And go out to all of the subtle realms also. So everything, and into your own mind, everything that is objectifiable, that whole infinite form, the form is what we call the Ishwara Upadhi. That's the form of Ishwara in the waking state, in the subtle state, and then we have a causal condition. But that, what we call Maya, that capacity to project the project the whole infinite universe, for it to be sustained here for how many, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, and then to resolve cyclically from beginningless time, that capacity is a capacity that the self has, this self that I am, this self, this one self that is the self in all beings, has that capacity naturally to project this infinite universe. Now, included in that infinite projection are all of the individuals. Like if you have a dream, that dream world is projected, but then there's all animals in it and human beings and all kinds of things going on in it. So we look at the whole universe as an infinite projection in which we are included, right? So when I say I am Ishwara, I don't mean this body mind sense organs. This body mind sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara. All of us are part of Ishwara, of that infinite projection. But the self, this self that now this body mind sense organs is identified with as me, is actually part of this infinite projection that we call Ishwara, which comes from that same self. That same self projects this whole world, and included in that world is me, this body-mind-sense organs, all body-mind-sense organs. And so the very self that is me is the self that is Ishwara. And Ishwara, this whole infinite creation, has no independent existence. Just like if you project your own universe right now, just okay, then you see whatever you project, okay. And then you pull it back. But that universe or that scene that you just projected has no independent reality at all. It belongs to the self, but it doesn't bring about any change to the self. So that's why we call it Maya, that which is but doesn't have any existence of its own. That's the meaning of Maya. It is, but it doesn't have any independent existence. That's why we call it Mitya. But this Maya, this creative capacity, when it's fully projected, that infinite projection reflects consciousness, enjoys consciousness, that we call the Abhimana. In the same way that when your mind would say, if I ask you to think of something, anything, and you say, think of a beautiful ocean scene, that whole scene reflects consciousness. It is known. So the whole infinite creation is like an infinite mind. And why I say that is because from its own standpoint, it enjoys consciousness, just like whatever, because of the sattva running through it, but because of that reflecting capacity that runs through it. So just like your mind, no matter what's in it, if it's positive or negative, whatever it is, it reflects consciousness. It has a sense of me. That's what I mean by reflecting consciousness. It has a sense of me, where I don't think that the chair does or the rug. You need that sattva, that reflecting capacity. So Ishwara has that. For Ishwara, it's Brahman, this conscious being that I am, with this Maya that projects the whole creation. The whole creation is like an infinite mind, is a conscious being. That's what we call it, the Lord or Ishwara. And so now, your body, mind, sense organs, also because of your subtle body, it also reflects consciousness and has this Abhimana. Means you, this whole body, mind, sense organs has the sense of self. This is me, I can say. You can't say that about the chair. The sense of me doesn't go over into the chair. It stops at this physical body because of the subtle body. Sense of touch, really. You know, and so this has an Abhimana. Abhimana means it takes itself to be a conscious being. It enjoys conscious beingness. The whole creation has that Abhimana also. It is me. From its own standpoint, that infinite creation is like an infinite mind. It has that Abhimana, that sense of being me. And so now this individual within the creation, who has a sense of me, can have a relationship with the whole, with Ishwara, because Ishwara also has that sense of me. But I have a limited sense of me. Ishwara's limitless sense of me. But I can have a prayerful, dialogical relationship with Ishwara. Because there's two senses of me here. From the standpoint of Maya, there's me who I'm related to the whole. So that's why prayer and relationship and all that is so powerful, actually. People don't think maybe, oh, they're just like, I don't know if you had to say prayers when you were a little girl or boy. I used to have to say these prayers. Now I may be down this week. You know, I just did it. I didn't mean so much to me. I don't know what it meant to me, really. I believed in God when I was little. Mm. And I said those prayers because my mother made them. Mm. But anyway, that relationship is much more real than that.
So are there two senses of me? I thought that
there's two senses of many senses of me from the Upadi. There's only one. The me actually belongs only to consciousness. That's a good point. Your own, the sense of me that I have, that is the nature of consciousness. So if you get rid of the whole universe, right, you get rid of the whole universe, that conscious me is there still. Nothing happens at all. But from the standpoint of all of these jivas, even though there's only one me, each jiva, because of ignorance, takes that me to belong to it, right? And from the Ishwara Upadi, Ishwara, the form of Ishwara, there is no ignorance there, but the Abhimana is still there. Like, even if you have self-knowledge, if it takes Swamiji or any of you that have self-knowledge, this body, mind, sense organs will still, because of the sattva, have that sense of me, because me is manifest in it, and at the same time, there's the changelessness of me that can be differentiated from the me that's reflected. You know, so you can, like, say now I'm talking, mm-hmm. and I'm hearing what I'm saying, and all of this stuff is going on. So that's enjoying consciousness or knownness, and there's me who I'm not doing anything. That's a viveka there, you know.
That almost sounds like a dual. I mean, you're sensing the changelessness and change.
Yeah, but the thing
simultaneously.
Is, yeah, but what is changing is mitya. So you have to understand what mitya is, mm-hmm. and what qualifies something as being mitya. Mitya means it has no. So it's a technical term about the order of reality of something. And so if something comes into being and goes out of being, that's non-existent starting to end. If it's infinitely divisible, then the thing that you thought was a thing actually isn't. It's a bunch of things. It's a conglomerate. But when you start to find out, well, what is actually here, that goes into an infinite regress and you can't find it. Mm-hmm. Also, if anything that comes into being, if you say it's come into being, then that means it came from non-existence, and nothing can come from non-existence. So therefore, it must have a material cause that exists. But as you try to discover the existent material cause, you can't in terms of name and form. It goes into infinite regress, but as it goes into infinite regress, every point of that regress exists, because the existence is what is actually here. Mm-hmm. So even when you break things down into smaller and smaller and smaller units, the being doesn't change at all. You know? Mm-hmm. So being is what is actually here. Like when you wake up from a dream, what is left? What was always there? That's why you don't... This dream went away, this whole universe went away. So much going on in there, so many people, so many, you know, so many high skyscrapers and everything. Boom! Nothing has happened. Whole thing wiped out. Absolutely nothing has happened, because what is actually there hasn't changed at all.
But what I was more curious about is that while you're talking, do you have a sense of both change and changelessness? Mm-hmm.
Yes. You have to sit quietly to notice that. I don't have to, because I noticed it, right? Mm-hmm. That's a long, long time ago. But you have to. You have to sit quietly. That's why contemplation is so good. You recognize that you are not doing anything at all. You just simply are. But the thoughts are known.
Yeah.
Right? The activities are known. So there's these two things happening, the maya that reflects the, in which the activities and, you know, sense perceptions and vrittis and thought modifications are all, reflect, they're all enjoying knownness. But you are doing absolutely nothing. You're always the same. You know, the very best sadhana for recognizing that is japa.
What is sadhana and what is japa?
The sadhana is the tool for recognizing that, and japa is the repetition of a mantra. Like, say, if you take Om Namah Shivaya. Because what happens is when you repeat that over and over again, you're breaking associative thinking, and then so then you can say the mantra Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. You say, do it 100 times or 50 times. And you stop. And then the mind doesn't have anything to think. Because you stop saying, you put an end to the associative thinking, it doesn't have another thing to think about. So it takes a few seconds anyway for another thought to come. And in that thought, in that time, you recognize that silence. And then you have mantra silence, mantra silence. But if you chant it for long enough, it's not very long, really, you realize that the mantra, this Om Namah Shivaya or whatever, is taking place in silence. So the mantra rises from silence and sets from silence, but the silence remains undisturbed. And then you can really recognize that you, the silent one, the silence, you're not doing anything at all. But the mantra is known silence, known silence. So the silence not being disturbed. Then you can see the maya, the kind of the magic of the whole thing. And so mantra, the japa, this repetition is very good for helping you recognize the changelessness of yourself. And once you recognize that, then these thoughts that are coming and going, it's just like japa. Mm-hmm. Really, because you recognize the underlying, your underlying being that is not changing at all. Or these thoughts, they can be coming and going, or you can be chain thinking or whatever. But your own being is always exactly the same. So japa is very helpful for that.
I had a thought when you were talking about the two as though two selves. Or I can't remember exactly how you talked about it, but I had a picture of being in nature, and you know, you see, when you're in nature, you're seeing multiplicity of all different plants and animals and clouds and mountains and so on, and yet there's this harmony.
That's right.
That's there.
Yeah.
So is that?
That's a very beautiful, it's very nice to take a walk in beautiful nature, and your mind becomes so quiet, you know, that it's as though your whole being just pervades the nature.
But it is the being.
It is. For you, what it would be in terms of you're having the experience of the nature, right? The mind relaxes into that experience. It's still a vritti. But the vritti has so much shanti, even though there's trees and all kinds of things in it. It has, that doesn't at all disrupt the deep peace of the vritti. And so when that type of peace is there, then your own being anyway pervades, you know. But you feel that pervasion. You feel yourself. You feel Ishwara, the presence of Ishwara, because your mind and your ahankara, the I notion, is so out of the way. So it's a beautiful experience. That's why we always recommend going out and taking walks in nature. You don't have to recommend it. People discover it on their own.
I guess what I'm trying to pinpoint is that experience of being in nature, just looking out and witnessing everything going on, and yet there's everything's connected. Everything seems undisturbed and in balance. Mm-hmm. That there is a sense of oneness and multiplicity going on at the same time, depending on how you're looking at it. Is it the pot or is it the clay? Kind of like that.
Well, I'm not sure if you're meaning the same thing. That your non-dual presence would be very dominant, as would Ishwara, and the jiva is kind of put to the side for the moment. Right? It's not really manifest, and so you're experiencing Ishwara and also your non-dual being at the same time, because there's nothing coming in the way of that. And as a jnani, As you know yourself and your mind starts to settle down, you experience that all the time. Yourself, as you are, it's not, your being is non-dual, it's free from time, so it's not big or small, it's just you and whatever is going on in your mind. And in fact, what's going on in the mind, you can say that is Ishwara. It can be Ishwara tainted by Jiva Srishti, but that's still Ishwara, because it still exists within duality, right? But what you will notice is that no matter what is going on in the mind, the upset or the calm or whatever it is, there's that going on, and there's you, and there's a viveka between the two. Even though it's not a viveka of distance, it's a viveka of non-dual me and the experience, whatever experience I'm having. But the beauty of it, and just the Ishwara Srishti, Ishwara's creation, is really highlighted, like, especially in walks in nature and things like that. There's other things too, listening to music.
So you make it sound like the nature has the power to kind of push away the jiva shrusti for
it. It tends to be one of the powerful things. Beautiful music can do that. The smile of a little child or your puppy, or so many things can do that. But nature is one that we often recognize.
That's why you're attracted. Really.
That's why it's so nice to do meditations in nature. Also, to just sit quietly.
What part of us has the relationship with Ishvara, and why is it Ishvara and not with Brahman?
Well, you are Brahman, so that's not going to be a relationship.
Okay.
So so the relationship is with this jiva upadi, this body, mind, sense organs, which reflects consciousness, right? That has a relationship with Ishvara, which reflects consciousness.
But it must be some part of the mind that has the ongoing. When I have this active ongoing part of me is
the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, which now has this physical body, that's traveling, from lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, that will always be in relationship with Ishvara.
So it's the whole upadi, not necessarily the buddhi or something.
Well, you would say it's the whole upadi, but the one who's. But it's going to be the buddhi, really. Oh. But it's the whole upadi, and the buddhi is part of that upadi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the buddhi's not floating around by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As all that there is Ishvara, then it's obviously that even the jiva srishti is also Ishvara.
Yes. But it originates out of. The jiva srishti, that's the creation of the individual's imagination and creation. Everything is part of Ishvara, but the jiva srishti originates out of the limited mind, ajnanam, born of ajnan, of the jiva. But all of that existed in Ishvara, but it originates out of.
Sorry, can you sort of say, okay, it originates from the jiva, but even that is Ishvara, so all that there is Ishvara.
That's right.
It's
even
just,
that is Ishvara.
It's just the recognition of that, there is just even an acceptance of the jiva. Srishti is also Ishvara.
That's right. And also the buddhi's ability to do. To do something about that jiva srishti also.
Yes. Yes.
But it's nice to know that it's all Ishvara.
Yeah. There's no alienation. There is just this oneness.
That's why being able to, all the things that jiva does and all your mistakes and this and that, and you can do better, and that's all true.
Mm.
But you can all welcome it. Like your little child, so you have a little child and it makes this mistake and that mistake. If you're a good parent, you're not going to be condemning and telling them how. that doesn't help. You have to. We all have to grow and learn. You have to think of the rose opening, the little rosebud opening, And then you give it plenty of water and protection. And let the sun shine on it, let it open and realize that even though you're so doing your best, things take time. To gain mastery of things, it takes time. And so to be patient. Patience is really important, actually. Patience and welcoming and having trust that you're a good person. We're all good people. You're a good person. You just have this issue and that issue that takes time to work out. It's not instantaneous. Once you become aware of some limitation you have, that's really the death toll for that problem. Because we have it, you become aware of it, but you've actually had it. Really long time. Everybody else is aware of it, just not. We become aware of it ourselves and we'll do something about it.
But it seems like the flavor of Swamiji's teaching in the beginning, it was all that the Shastra would take care of it, and all you need to do is appreciate.
And then the Westerners came.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can.
He said, "Why isn't this working?"
Oh, so then he
because of deep complexes and And also, you know, that's a good question, but it's a multifaceted question.
Yeah.
Another thing, in the Indian culture, they keep certain types of problems totally to themselves. They look at, it's like, why do you, one guy who was a friend of mine, actually, he was very serious and became a Swami later, he once said, why do Westerners, why are they always, like, exposing their dirty laundry? Mm-hmm. We never do that. It's like, it's very embarrassing. You know, these we don't talk about these kind of things, you know.
I have an answer to that. Christianity's need for confession. That's probably where it comes from.
That's good, yeah. You know, in Jungian psychology, Jung also felt like therapy was... He took it to four different stages, but the first phase in the therapeutic process was confession, like a confessional.
Yeah. Well, how do they wash their laundry then?
In the Ganga.
That's the puzzle.
They take a dip.
But also, the guru-sisha relationship is in India much more structured than we even would know about. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did find out about all of that, but initially I had no idea. And we were much more, not in our mind in any way rude, but much more casual and wanting to talk and all of these type of things, where the Indian students were just thinking, what are they doing? Mm. This is not right.
Rude.
Yeah, rude and all of this. But for us, that really talking about things is so natural to us, and it really wasn't. It's more now, maybe, for them. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Well, Swamiji wasn't.
Swamiji was what we call a Jagat Guru. He was a teacher for the world, and he always learned about everybody and their cultures and appreciated it. He is so beautiful for just appreciating every culture and people from every culture.
He accepted us Westerners.
Yeah, as we were.
Yes,
and learned about it and wanted Westerners. To help. Wanted to help.
Because
these
like
were great jokes, too. Mm-hmm. Like, have you driven a Ford lately? I love it when you tell that one.
Yeah. Okay, everybody.
Did I hear an om?
Well, you did. You stuck out. I'm going to say a prayer. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishah Govramanebhyah Shubhamasya Nityam Loka samasa supino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho varahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkha Bhat Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om